Well, good morning, everybody. So kids, if you're in the audience or at home, I'm going to tell you something you missed out on this morning. If you're a kid in the audience, will you raise your hand if you ever went to the store Toys R Us? Anybody? Any kid? Okay, we got one. You got it right before it went out. Well, very sadly, Toys R Us are like no longer a thing, and it is very sad news because, kids, if you don't know what I'm talking about, I want you to imagine a store the size of Walmart. But instead of just one section being toys, imagine that the entire store is full of toys, like every single aisle. This was one of my favorite toys store or stores in general to go to growing up as a kid, and I was just, it was just full of wonder. Just aisle after aisle, toy after toy, and I went there many times. I always ended up walking away with the Super Soaker water gun. Anybody know what Super Soaker water guns are? It's great. But sadly, Toys R Us is no more. They went bankrupt in 2017. But interesting story. 2019, they attempted a comeback to the joy of many children. How many people think they made the comeback? You are correct. It was a failed comeback. 2019 probably wasn't the best year to start a comeback like this, but it wasn't just the pandemic that stifled the comeback. Toys R Us actually adopted a totally new strategy when they tried to come back. Instead of really, really big stores, they went with small ones. Instead of focusing on aisles and aisles of toys, they went with birthday parties and interactive games. And the comeback failed. And my theory is that they had a really good strategy, but they lost the heart of what the store was, and so it just didn't work. See, strategy is really, really important, and especially when it comes to a comeback, but strategy is not the only thing. And so this is actually week two in a series called Make a Comeback. Started it 2 weeks ago, and then we took a break for Family Blessing Sunday. And the idea of the series is that in the middle of the Old Testament, we have the story of the people of God who have been in exile, and they make a comeback. And we also find ourselves in the middle of a time where we're trying to make a comeback, come back as people, come back as a business, come back as your business, come back as our church. And how do we do that? Like, how do we make a comeback? And what's really interesting to me with this story of Ezra and Zerubbabel is the first one that makes the comeback with these people is that they do have a strategy. Like, they've got all sorts of plans and ideas of how they're going to come back to the city and how they're going to rebuild the temple and eventually the wall and eventually, like, all of society and their own civilization, their own nation is going to come back, and they have all these plans and all these ideas and all these strategies, but that's not what they do when they first get there. I think this is so instructive what Zerubbabel and his fellow Israelites do when they first get back to the land of Israel. So I want to read to you Ezra chapter 3, starting in verse 1. When the seventh month came and the Israelites had settled in their towns, the people assembled together as one in Jerusalem. Then Joshua, son of Jozadak, and fellow priests, and Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, and his associates began to build the altar of God of Israel and to sacrifice burnt offerings on it in accordance with what is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. Now, here's what I find just so super important about these first few verses here. The first thing that Israel does when they go back to their homeland, it's not to spend all this time planting a bunch of vineyards and get the farms going and let's kickstart the economy. The very first thing they do is they worship. They worship. And so as I think about, like, our church family and going forward, to be honest, where my mind has been the last few weeks has been like all strategy, like what's next and where do we go from here and how do we get reconnected and what are our new plans for the future and how do we come out of this and what are the right questions to ask and how do we seize the opportunity? And that's where my mind has been, and maybe that's where your mind has been. But the question I want to present to you this morning is, when was the last time that you came to the feet of Jesus and just said, I just want to worship you? Like, I'm not going to think about my busy schedule. I'm just going to clear my mind. I'm going to clear my life for just this one moment and do what I need to do, which is just worship. You see, we've been in a spiritual exile, I'm convinced, for quite a while, and I'm not even sure if we understand how bad it is. And so for a lot of us, what we desperately need more than anything else is to fall at the feet of Jesus and have an encounter with the living God. That's what they did. It's the first lesson of a comeback. You have to start with worship. So I want to answer three simple questions about worship this morning for the message. I want to talk about what is it? What is worship? Why do we do it? And then how do we do it? What is it? Why do we do it? How do we do it? I read about a dozen definitions of worship getting ready for this message, and one really stuck out to me. It's this longtime biblical scholar named Warren Wiersbe, and his definition of worship is this. Worship is the believer's response of all that he is, mind, emotion, will, and body, to all that God is, says, and does. And I really resonated with that definition of worship because it talks about the complexity of a human being. Like it's every part of me. It's my mind, it's my body, it's my soul, it's every fiber of my being responding to all of who God is. Everything he says, everything he does, all of who he is. So it's a response. So God makes the first move here. God has done something decisively in history and continues to do things today. And when we recognize what he's actually doing, then the proper response is, it's worship. It's everything in me responding to everything in him. Tim Keller is a prolific author, and he talks about worship this way. He has a great illustration for it. He says, imagine that a woman is digging around in her jewelry box, and she finds this bracelet, and so she doesn't really know where it came from or what it's worth, and so she takes it to get appraised, and she goes before the appraiser, and the appraiser starts looking at it, and he gets his magnifying glass, and he's really studying this bracelet, looking at the cut and the clarity and all those specifics that they look at. And then the appraiser just drops the bracelet. His eyes get really big. And he says, ma'am, you're not going to believe this, but this is actually thousands of years old. It belonged to this Egyptian royal family, and we don't even know how to cut jewels this way anymore. The value of this bracelet is you can't put money on it. It's truly priceless. And then the woman, when she hears this information, what do you think she's going to do? She's going to jump out of her chair, and she's going to put her hands on her head. She's going to put her hands in the air. She's going to ask lots of questions. She's going to exclaim shouts of joy because she had no idea how much value was in this bracelet. And then going on from there, not only is she going to, in the moment, react, she's probably going to reorder her whole life based on the value of this bracelet once she understood its value. That's worship. When we can fully grasp who God is and then we actually give him everything that we have inside ourselves, that's what worship is. Now, why is it important? Why can't we just keep living our life and doing our thing and trying to learn the right things and just be smart people and make wise decisions? Like, isn't that just enough? Like, why do we really need to talk about this worship thing? Well, again, the book of Ezra is pretty helpful here, so I want to go back to this passage. Still in chapter 3, it's the very next verse, and New American Standard Version captures the wording here a little closer to the original language, and so here's what this verse reads, very next verse. They, as in the Israelites, they set up this altar, so they're about to worship. They set up the altar on its foundation because they were terrified of the peoples of the lands. That's a weird verse. They're setting up an altar to worship because they're terrified of these people. Like, why would they do that? Well, here's what several of the scholars I read said about this. So when Israel got exiled from their homeland, the reason was because they had taken on foreign gods from these pagan people, and they had adopted all sorts of horrible practices. And so now they're back in the land, and it's not like the land has been totally empty. In fact, some of these other people and nations, they still have remnants left over of their nations, just like Israel does. And so when they come back to this land, there are other people that don't worship God. And because those people are there that don't worship God, that gives Israel the motivation to say, we have to do this. We're going to worship precisely because we don't want to get wrapped up into the worship of these other gods. And so here's why worship is so important in your life. It's because worship protects you from idolatry. See, everybody worships. We all do. The world is not divided between the people that worship and the people that don't worship. We're all in the same boat. Everybody is a worshiper of something. You've just got the, you've got the Yahweh worshipers, and then you've got the Your Way worshipers. But the truth is, like, we're all in the same boat. Every single human being has some object at the center of their life, and depending on what that object is, it has drastic ramifications on the well-being of the individual. So there's a pretty brilliant writer named David Foster Wallace. He was author, intellectual, had a tragically passed away in 2008, but he gave a commencement speech shortly before he passed away, and he had just a really, really some helpful words about this subject. Here's what he said in this commencement speech. He says, "Here's something else that's true. In the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there's actually no such thing as atheism. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what we worship. And pretty much anything you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they are where you tap real meaning in life, then you will never have enough. Worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, and you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally plant you. Worship power and you'll feel weak and afraid, and you will need ever more power over others to keep your fear at bay. Worship your intellect, being seen as smart, and you will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out." Those are really, really strong words. And the point is, we all worship something. Like, whatever has the corner on your mind and your heart and your time, that's what you worship. And again, it could be a sport. It could be a person. It could be a political party. It could be a news channel. It could be a hobby. It could be a conspiracy theory. But whatever has the corner on your mind and your heart and your time, that is the object of your worship. And depending on what you worship, it has drastic ramifications on your spiritual well-being. So Paul wrote this fascinating verse in Romans chapter 1. Romans 1 is an amazing chapter. So Paul's writing in a time where he doesn't really know modern world problems. Like, he doesn't know about modern-day terrorism, and he doesn't know about, like, modern-day internet pornography. Like, he doesn't know about all those things, and yet he's writing in his day about the world. And here's what Paul does know in Romans 1. Paul knows the world's totally messed up. He knows the world is full of sin and greed and violence and hate and sexual immorality, and he knows it's totally out of whack. And Romans 1 is Paul's way of attempting to explain how it got there. And there's this one verse that's so, so important. So most of the chapter, Paul is talking about all these ways the world is messed up. But then if you go back to the source of it all, here's what Paul says is the source of all the world's problems. Romans chapter 1, verse 16. They worshipped, or 25. They worshipped and served created things rather than the Creator. That's the source of all the problems. And so if you trace this back, Paul is saying all the problems in the world can ultimately come back to sin. Sin is what led to all these problems. But then if you keep going backwards, sin, the source of sin is false worship. The reason we sin at all is because we've started worshiping the wrong things. There's people who worship the Creator, and there's people that worship created things. And if you worship created things, your life's never going to be what it was meant to be. You see, worshiping anything other than God, it deforms your very soul. And on the flip side, true worship makes you truly human, like the most authentic, compassionate, loving, kind you is the worshiping you. The more you worship, the more you become who you were supposed to be. And that's why Ezra built this altar first, before he did all the planting vineyards and let's restart civilization. The reason he built this altar first, Zerubbabel and all these people, is because they knew that they had to put worship first. And another thing that's interesting about this passage in the book of Ezra is that it wasn't just like a one-time deal. Okay, let's get the worship over with and then let's move on with our life. If you read the text closely, they did sacrifices in the morning. They did sacrifices in the evening. Zerubbabel even brought back the Feast of Tabernacles, which was this week-long celebration of getting out of the wilderness. And so worship wasn't just a one-time thing. They knew they had to make it a lifestyle if they ever had any fighting chance of not falling back into the idolatry of these other people. And, see, and here's the second reason I would say that worship is so important, is because worship, it reminds us of our story. Like, it reminds us of who we are. Like, you might be different than me, but I, to be honest, sometimes just throughout the week, I kind of forget. I get wrapped up in all sorts of other stories, and so when I come to church and when I worship, it's like, oh yeah, that's who I am. I called one of our members a while back, a few months ago, a member I knew that was hurting and going through a hard time, but she had dementia. And so I knew that she probably wouldn't remember the conversation, but I called her anyway. We talked for quite a while, and I was just reminded that for the loved ones taking care of people with Alzheimer's or dementia, it's so hard because you don't really know what they're going to remember and what they're not going to remember. But as we know just from research and science, one thing that most people with dementia or Alzheimer's do remember is they remember songs. And so isn't that interesting that for all of us, we might lose our minds, but we're not going to lose our songs. Our songs are so powerful. One of my favorite songs is The Great Redeemer, but if you think about it, when you take worship in general, worship in the big picture is the great reminder. It recaptures who we actually are, because again, what happens is you and I, we go throughout the week and it's like we just get wrapped up into all these other storylines. It's the story of money. It's the story of power. It's the story of fame. It's the story of personal happiness. And Monday through Saturday, that's all we think about. And so when we come into this place and we sing these songs, it reminds us this is who you are. You're a citizen of the kingdom of God, bought with the blood of a Savior, commissioned to carry the gospel to the world. I forget that. You forget that. And so what worship does is it reminds us of our story. So let's talk for a moment about how we do it. Well, I want to spend the rest of the message just on one part of the Bible. Scott read this psalm earlier, but it's such a powerful psalm. In fact, I would say, as far as just if you're looking for a one passage that teaches here's how to worship, Psalm 95, arguably the best chapter in the Bible on worship. I want to read parts of it again. Verse 1, come, let us sing with joy to the Lord. Let us shout aloud to the rock of our salvation. Let us come before him with thanksgiving and extol him with music and song. Now, there's so much joy and elation in this little verse here. And I would just say, make sure when you worship, worship with your emotion. Like this psalm gives you permission to worship with your emotion. I mean, think about this. It talks about shouting in this psalm. When was the last time you shouted without emotion? I don't know. Maybe somebody did, but probably none of us have. Because when we shout, we're either A, angry, or B, really excited. And I can tell you the psalmist here is not angry, and so he is shouting with this emotion of joy. We're allowed to do that. One of the reasons I have loved being able to travel so often over the course of my life to Central America for mission trips is because of the way that many Christians sing in Central America. It's so moving. It seems that they care more about passion than precision. They just sing, and they don't care a lot about how it sounds, but they just sing from the heart. And there's something so moving to me about that. And sometimes, I don't know if you're like me, I do get caught up like, well, I'm not the best singer, and what if I miss this note? What if I miss that note? And I certainly can't hear harmony. I wish I could. But on my better days, I don't even think about it. I just get lost. I get lost in the words. I get lost in the music. I get lost in the emotion of just praising God. And again, the psalm gives you permission to worship with your emotions. Here's how the psalm continues. For the Lord is the great God, the great King above all gods. In his hands are the depths of the earth. The mountain peaks belong to him. The sea is his, for he made it, and his hands formed the dry land. And then there's a shift in the psalm in verse 6 where the psalmist says this, come, let us bow down in worship. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker, for he is our God, and we're the people of his pasture, the flock under his care. And so the psalmist goes from shouting to kneeling. Isn't that interesting? It's in the same psalm. He's shouting at the top of his lungs, praise God, and then he's on his knees. He's falling before God. So here's the second thing the psalm teaches is worship with your body. James K. Smith is a modern author, has written a lot of books, but he wrote a book a few years ago that's always stuck out to me where he made the point that we are not brains on a stick. Like, you're not just a mind. You're more than your intellect. And sometimes we, especially kind of enlightenment kind of people, educated people, tend to hide behind our knowledge. But what the psalmist is saying is you're a body. And the whole Bible would... The whole Bible resonates to this particular point. Paul says your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit. When God decides to incarnate himself into the world, he doesn't pick a building or an angel. He picks a person, like he becomes a body. When Jesus rises from the dead and he's meeting with his disciples, he says, touch and see, this is a body. He says, give me a piece of fish. Like there's an embodied sense for even the resurrection itself. Like you are not just a mind, you are a body. And the psalmist is saying, you can worship with your body. And all over the Bible, we read about all sorts of postures. At certain points in the Bible, people are kneeling. At other points in the Bible, people are laying prostrate before God. Or Psalm 63 says it, in your name, I lift up my hands. Like there's postures all throughout the Bible, and they're there for a reason. And it's not so that we can seek attention for ourselves. It's so we can worship in submission to God. That's what posture does. Your spirit often follows what your body does. And this psalm teaches, yes, worship with your emotion, but you can worship with your body. Third thing the psalm teaches, and this is such a jarring turn, but you got to stick with me here. It's basically my last point, and then we're going to worship for a while. But the very next section of this psalm, after he says, you shout to the rooftops and you get on your knees, very next line says this. Today, if you only would hear his voice, don't harden your hearts. You're probably familiar with that verse because it's quoted in the New Testament, but did you know it came in a psalm of worship? And I think the psalmist is trying to make a point here, and that the third way to worship is you got to worship through obedience. It's not just about what happens in the moment, it's about what happens after the moment. And I will confess to you, I have certain seasons of my life where I would say my interesting bucket is this big and my action bucket or action cup is this small. And here's what I mean by that. I'm a preacher. I'm always reading books and listening to podcasts, listening to sermons, reading articles. And so the amount of information I take in a week is very extensive. And there are certain seasons of life where I find myself just thinking, oh, that's an interesting book, interesting article. Thanks for passing that along. Really enjoyed that sermon. Like this podcast. Love this book. And I just dump all these things in this bucket. It's all interesting. Like, wow, we could talk about this. Let's analyze this argument. And then what I actually do is so small. And maybe you're the same way in your life that you're a sponge for great content. And you're always looking for the next best book and the next great article and the next good sermon. You're like, oh, just give me more, give me more, give me more. And my question would be, and Psalm 95's question would be, what are you doing about it? Like, is there any action? Like, maybe you resonate with this one. Have you ever read your Bible and just thought, wow, this is so good? And then you just don't really do anything about it. Like you enjoy it, but you don't obey it. Or maybe you've come to a worship service before and you've just felt so convicted. Like, oh, I've got to do this. And then you walk out the door and you get lost back into your routine. And you forget that anything happened. Like the surest way to not hear from God is to not listen. And the truth is, a lot of people show up at church every Sunday or watch from your home every Sunday, and you're only listening for something interesting. Well, just give me a little bit to tickle my brain so I can move on with my week. But again, the Bible, God, Jesus, the Spirit, Psalm 95 are begging you, do something about it. I mean, the reason the New Testament quotes this verse is because it's so hard. Like, don't harden your hearts. Like, so many of us have got rock hard hearts, and we don't need more information. We got to do something about it. You are called to be way more than an informed citizen of this country. You are called to be a transformed disciple of Jesus. And that requires way more than information. That requires action. And so that's what the psalm ends on, is obedience. You got to worship through your emotion, worship through your body, but then worship through obedience. You got to do something about it. Last story I'll tell you, and then we're going to sing for a while. I don't even know how many years ago this was, 4 or 5 years ago. I just preached a sermon. I talked a little bit about posture. I was walking out the building. Nobody else was here. I ran into Norma Morgan in the children's wing. And if you don't know Norma Morgan, she has been volunteering here for years. And her big thing is she loves holding babies. She loves taking care of this building. And so I passed her on my way out, and she stops me, and she says, "Well, I enjoyed your sermon today." I said, "Thanks, Norma." And Norma said, "Well, I noticed one thing you didn't do." I said, "What was that?" And she said, "You actually didn't ask us to kneel. Why didn't you ask us to kneel?" And I said, "Well, I try to be really mindful of people that can't physically do that. And I don't want to put someone in an uncomfortable position in worship when that would just really hurt their body." And Norma said, "I get that. I really appreciate you thinking about people like me." And I'm one of those people, Norma says. It would have been really hard for me to kneel. But then she said, I'll never forget this. She said, "But Phil, you need to know something. If you had asked me to kneel, I would have done it." And I said, "Why?" And she said, "Because there are certain things that I would do for God and my grandkids that I wouldn't do for anybody else." And I thought, Norma, that is a fantastic line. There are certain things that you should do for God that you shouldn't do for anything else, anybody else. And first and foremost is worship. God has called all of you, your mind, your body, your soul, to Him. And so we're gonna sing for a little while. We're going to take communion together, which again reminds us of our great story. And if you need to respond to this, like we've been doing the last few months, you can respond at the end in any way you want to. But like right now, I'm just telling you, just like Psalm 95 says, don't harden your hearts. Like, you might have walked into the building today thinking, "Oh, it's just another ho-hum worship service. Nothing's going to happen." Well, if you think that, nothing's going to happen. But if you can change your heart and think, "I want to meet God right now," my guess is it's going to happen. So let's worship together.